Kost was hardly the triumph that Schnabel and Wilson had envisioned. It was like a ghost town when we arrived. The bazaar, which had been full just days before, was empty. Everyone had fled the liberators. Nothing moved except armed Mujahideen soldiers. Many of the warriors were said to be radical Arabs who had come to get in on the jihad. There was little sign of life and few prospects of people returning any time soon. The most chilling story we heard was of the sound trucks that Crandall's cross-border program had dispatched to Kost as the Mujahideen moved in to take the city. Instead of devoting its energies to rebuilding Afghanistan, as they had hoped, the cross-border program found itself following the liberators in a desperate attempt to persuade them not to murder and pillage. None of this attracted any real attention in the world press, which had either forgotten about or lost interest in Afghanistan, in spite of the fact that the CIA and the KGB were continuing to mount the largest covert Cold War battle in history. For all practical purposes, the Cold War was over, and it seemed as if the United States and Russia had come to share roughly the same long-term goals in Afghanistan. The only logical explanation for why the two superpowers were now funding this mysterious war of the tribes was the force of inertia. Simply put, neither side wanted to be the first to pull back. In Islamabad, however, someone with enough stature to call the entire program into question suddenly clocked in. Ambassador Robert Oakley was a hardliner, a champion of the program. His wife Phyllis had been the Afghan desk officer when Wilson first took up the cause, and Oakley had been the NSC staff man for Afghanistan. He had taken over his current post when his predecessor, Arnie Raffel, died in the plane crash with President Zia. Oakley was, in short, an activist, an ambassador who made sure that Bearden and the ISI chief, Hamid Ghul, understood that when it came to intelligence matters, the three of them were a triumvirate. He was there when Gulbuddin and Massoud resumed their blood feud, when the Mujahideen began stealing health funds, when two of the CIA's oldest Afghan allies came out for Saddam. He had been sufficiently concerned about the rise of anti-American sentiment in Pakistan during the Gulf War to evacuate the embassy and urge all Americans to leave the country. And now, watching the rise of radical Islam, he questioned whether the freedom fighters even existed any longer. It was almost unthinkable, but he now wondered if our Afghans, no longer menaced by the Red Army, were any different from the Afghans whom the Russians were backing. In fact, it was the leaders of the Afghan puppet government who were saying all the right things, even paying lip service to democratic change. The Mujahideen, on the other hand, were committing unspeakable atrocities and couldn't even put aside their bickering and murderous thoughts long enough to capture Kabul. Even if the Mujahideen finally took the country, Oakley asked himself, would they be sympathetic to us, and would we want anything to do with them? Oakley had looked down every alley for a rationalization for continuing the CIA program, and he always came upon the same signpost. What's a nice group of kids like us doing in a place like this? Without the Russians around, did we really want to be giving long-range stingers, satellite-guided mortars, burst transmitters, and hundreds of millions of dollars worth of ordnance to these men? Crandall's cross-border program was all but powerless to stop the carnage. The image of the caravans following our warriors wherever they triumphed, blaring out messages of restraint, admirable though it may have been, seemed misguided. It was like a scene out of Apocalypse Now. Lunatic, crazed shooting of everything that moved, followed by a heroic humanitarian gesture to save a small dog or child. This was not what had led Bob Oakley to become an American ambassador. He had been a hardliner when the Russians were the evil empire. But as he assessed the U.S. presence in Afghanistan and Pakistan, he drew the conclusion that America's national interests were not being served. His recommendation was to cut off the Mujahideen, and he began moving about in key political circles in Pakistan, telling the ISI and the Mujahideen leaders that the United States was getting out. "We've given it the old college try. We've stayed with the Mujahideen for 2.5 years. It's actually been 3.5 since Gorbachev told Reagan that the Russians were pulling out. It's up to them now." Oakley's opinions counted. He was Jim Baker's former college roommate and a friend of President Bush, and he was prepared to suggest that American policy should have changed when the 40th Army withdrew. The Mujahideen had helped end the Cold War, the Saudis had helped bankroll the effort, and both would consider it disloyal if the United States cut and ran. But the United States had done its part, and each year it seemed that Najibullah only grew stronger, and the Mujahideen only more divided, less attractive, maybe even dangerous. Oakley's fear was that they might win, and we'd have to cope with the spectacle of our freedom fighters running riot, all in the name of a CIA freedom campaign. Wilson was surprised that spring to hear that the administration was not putting in a request for more money. There had been meetings in Wilson's office and talks with Judge William Webster, the new director of Central Intelligence, about the coming year's budget, but the agency was no longer of a single mind. The Bush administration, however, wanted out of this game, so the CIA's seventh floor had no choice but to reflect the opinion of their masters in the White House. But no one could just turn off Charlie Wilson's war like that. Not when the new men running the CIA's Afghan program had long since learned Gust's trick of appearing unannounced and without authorization to suggest that, in spite of official CIA policy, there were those in the agency who felt that it would be a shame not to see this battle through to its proper conclusion. With no request for funds, the Senate Select Committee met and reported out a bill with nothing in it for Afghanistan. On September 30, 1991, the end of the fiscal year, the flow of weapons, ammunition, and supplies that the Mujahideen had so dearly loved would stop. But for Charlie Wilson, there was something fundamentally wrong with his war ending then and there. He didn't like the idea of the United States going out with a whimper. The president might want to end the war, but it wasn't his war to end. It had always been Congress's war, and just because there was disarray at the CIA didn't mean Congress should step back. That was the essence of the appeal Wilson made to his highly reluctant colleagues on the House Intelligence Committee when they met to consider the annual budget. Incredibly, he carried the day. No one knew how to say no to Charlie. "Where will we get the money?" the chairman of the Intelligence Committee asked. "Doesn't matter," Wilson said in his most selfless tone. "Take it from a Texas defense contract, whatever. The main thing is, this body should not be cutting off the Mujahideen." "Well, shit, how about $25 million? McCurdy asked, meaning $25 million per quarter, $100 million for the year. "How about $50 million? Wilson responded. And $50 million a quarter is what they ultimately agreed on. With the Saudi contribution, that meant another $400 million for the Mujahideen. It was only the beginning of the extraordinary maneuvers Wilson had to make to push this bill through a highly reluctant Congress. By then, even his most reliable ally, John Murtha, the chairman of the Defense Appropriations Subcommittee, wanted to end the CIA program. Murtha was appalled at reports of the Mujahideen's drug trafficking, but in the end he stood with Charlie, and his support guaranteed the bill's passage in the House. It was passed in the Senate that fall. The secret appropriation was hidden in the $298 billion defense bill for fiscal year 1992. When it was presented for a vote, no one but the interested few noticed the $200 million earmarked for the Afghans. And so, as the Mujahideen were poised for their 13th year of war, instead of being cut off, it turned out to be a banner year. They found themselves with not only a $400 million budget, but also with a cornucopia of new weaponry sources that opened up when the United States decided to send the Iraqi weapons captured during the Gulf War to the Mujahideen. However disgraceful the Mujahideen's conduct was in the following months, in April 1992 they managed to stop fighting one another long enough to take Kabul. Once again, Charlie felt vindicated. He had stayed the course and allowed the victory that belonged to the Afghans to occur. But then everything became ugly. By August, the interim foreign minister, Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, was outside of the capital with his artillery shelling the positions of his former comrade-in-arms, the interim defense minister, Ahmad Shah Massoud. Kabul, which had survived the entire Afghan war relatively intact, was suddenly subjected to intense urban warfare. Before it was over, close to 40% of the housing was destroyed, the art museum was leveled, the palace ravaged. Under normal circumstances, such misuse of American resources should have led to a scandal, or at least entered the American consciousness as an issue of concern. But the anarchy in Kabul was completely overshadowed by the historic events sweeping the world. In December 1991, the Soviet Union ceased to exist. Everywhere across the 12 time zones of the former Soviet Union, statues of Lenin were coming down, and freedom was breaking out in a Russia reborn. People everywhere were now referring to the United States as the world's lone superpower.